Welcome to part two of our chat with Ryan Horn of Wake Forest Basketball. In this interview, we talk about sport-specific conditioning and how to peak athletes for pinnacle events. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast. Maximum performance, minimum fun. Critical wisdom and actionable insights from leading minds in the field of human performance around the globe. And now, here's your host, Jake George Schuster.
Welcome back to the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast. We're rolling through the tape, and we've got part two here with Ryan Horn of Wake Forest Basketball. I'm pretty excited to be calling over to North Carolina because I can just daydream about what autumn is like there and the fishing and the sailing. Ryan is taking his team through preseason right now. So first of all, welcome back. And second of all, how is preseason treating you?
Well, thanks for having me back. I'm glad to be brought back for a part two. It means that part one didn't suck too bad. So that's good. I'm glad that you called me back for a second run at it. But no, everything's going well. Preseason's going extremely well. Our guys did a fantastic job preparing themselves in the off season. And now we're able to kind of display that hard work in this preseason period, which has been phenomenal for our guys. And it's also been great for our coaches to see the work the guys have put in. So it's been great.
Now I know that I've found, Ryan, that one of the biggest challenges of preseason is obviously the different ways that the athletes present. So some are in great shape, some are not so great shape. Some have tried getting bigger, or some want to get bigger in that preseason period, or some it's the opposite. And especially in your case, you'll have freshmen, right? So you'll have the athletes who you haven't trained before, and you'll have some who might be wanting to use that season to prepare to go pro. So how do you balance all of the different needs of the athletes alongside the general need, getting everyone ready for the season?
Yeah, I think we look at the preseason period. I mean, we roughly get 4 weeks to kind of sharpen the edge of that spear, so to speak. So when we look at the spring period and we're coming out of the season, that's a time for us where we can focus on some anatomical adaptations and put some lean muscle mass on the guys, kind of put them back together from the season, so to speak, and kind of figure out where we're at, how we held up during the season, what are some things that we need to work on, and what direction do we need to go. Then once we get in that summer period, the summer period, as we discussed in our previous podcast, is a huge time for us. That's a 10-week, period where we can really push the envelope from the maximal strength, speed, and power perspective. So that's a big time for us. It's a very crucial time in our development, not only for our upperclassmen and our returners, but also for our freshmen as well, just to get an idea of how they adapt to stress, how they tolerate stress, and then we can move them through that period. So when we look at our strength, power, reactive, elastic abilities, all those foundational qualities for which a lot of our sport and our skill are built off of, those are generated heavily in that off-season period. Fitness for our guys playing the game of basketball, we're playing pickup all the time. We're practicing a majority of the year, so our fitness is designed to kind of fill those gaps, both on the higher end and the lower end spectrum, and then figure out what our guys need from a risk profile standpoint when it comes to their cardiovascular fitness, and kind of have an idea of, who's at risk due to poor conditioning, some of our bigger guys, and then who's, obviously doing a great job with how they're preparing physically. So that's a good time for that. And then as we try to kind of transition into this preseason period now, it's a time for us that we kind of get away from the track and some of our general alactic power speed work, and we kind of try to incorporate some more not necessarily skill development, but more non-pattern, non-program reactive agility drills and movement drills, and focus more on capacity. Now we've built the engine, now we work on sustaining power, recovering, and then kind of building up our capacity from that standpoint. So we focus on lactic capacity. We'll do some aerobic development, and then obviously we're going to expose the guys to a little bit of lactic or glycolytic work just to prepare them for the preseason boot camp period that our coaching staff runs that we're currently in right now, that kind of almost finishes us off and then takes us into official practice, which starts next week. So I think from that standpoint, going back to what we spoke about before, it's, knowing what gaps we need to fill having a comprehensive athlete testing profile, and then structuring our training and our emphasis of our training blocks according to where we're at in that year.
I know in our last chat, Ryan, that we talked a lot about specificity and uniqueness of basketball, but I want to return to that a little bit. I was talking recently with a colleague about kind of the specificity of training for rugby and how we can do all these tests, but there's nothing like playing the sport. And similarly, I think you can do all this training and this weightlifting and this running, but there's nothing like playing the sport. How do you know that your athletes are fit enough to play basketball, and how do you get them fit enough?
I guess the question I would think would be was, are they fit enough to practice? I think when we look at the games and we look at how they play, you know, our guys are going to play, you know, it's a 40-minute game. You know, our guys are going to average anywhere from our top-tier players going to play, you know, 25, 20-plus minutes a game. It's very easy for us to kind of look at our data, look at our track, and understand what the demands and the needs are during our games and during our practices. But when I look at practice, for me, it's important that our guys can make it through and not just survive a practice, but thrive in that environment, and understanding what Coach Manning wants to do, what type of demand he's going to place on the student athletes, and then preparing them for that demand. So when you look at our acute and chronic fatigue and our chronic load over time, most of that load is generated from our practice sessions leading into that. So I think when you look at fitness and you look at what we're doing, our guys play plenty of basketball. I probably, you know, people saw our fitness program and what we do from a conditioning perspective, you know, in the off season, they'd probably be like, that's all you do. And it's true, because our guys are getting on the court, they're getting up and down, they're playing. And then what we try to do is use our tempo runs and our general aerobic development to kind of build up that base and build up that overall capacity, and use our strength and our power training to make them more mechanically efficient and allow them to play, and not only play at a higher level, but sustain those levels. So when I view it, I'm more concerned with making sure our guys can make it through practice, that we prepared them properly, and that'll allow them to perform at a higher level in the game. You know, our guys, you know, I'm blessed to have guys in the coaching staff that you know, really for us, you know, conditioning is never really a big issue unless you have a big guy, which we have a couple of 7-footers, and those guys, big hearts, big guys, they're not used to being pushed and being trained like that. So we do have to do some more work with those guys. But it goes back again of knowing what the demands are, knowing what type of heart rates and what type of, you know, internal load and external load is being placed on these players. And then using our training to, you know, facilitate those qualities. But even then, you know, basketball's, you know, aerobic, it's elastic, and there is, you know, a threshold demand. So I have to understand, and my staff, you know, I have our assistant AJ Kerr that works with our team, is phenomenal. And he's been here for almost, you know, going on 4 months now. You know, him seeing it and seeing how basketball works, it's important to understand compatible training means as well, like Dr. Isherin has gone over in his books, of understanding if we're pushing glycolytic and threshold work all the time, then speed, power, and lean muscle mass, you know, gains are going to be, you know, deterred, so to speak, because those aren't really necessarily compatible training means, as you know, in our system, in our program. So I definitely think it's a long-term thing, but I think you have to be dynamic with it and then go from there.
Yeah, I think that last point that you touched on is really important, Ryan. I feel like I've fallen more and more into the line of thought that we will benefit from separating kind of skill-based training or training skill sets versus training capacities, and like, you know, exposing the hamstrings to high-velocity running is completely different kettle of fish from teaching a crossover step, or, you know, just teaching stride length, or even teaching jumping technique. And that, I don't really know if we can train both at once or both in the same session. Would you agree with that? And if so, how do you kind of split those up, especially as we talked about last time with a busy schedule in mind?
Yeah, and I think when you look at those qualities, it goes back to the game. You know, my guys aren't covering a ton of high speed distance and putting a lot of stimulus, a lot of stress on the hamstrings. You know, hamstring injuries in basketball are extremely rare. It's an acceleration dominant sport. So when I look at it, I don't have to necessarily be as cognizant or put as much emphasis on some of that higher velocity or terminal velocity type sprinting. We will use it for a training effect, but I don't have to necessarily prepare from that. And then when I've worked with soccer and field sports, it's a completely different dynamic as far as how we're kind of setting up that weekly stressor sequence, so to speak. But for basketball, it's understanding that, you know, for us, the weight room is extremely important. Our skill development, these guys are already highly specialized. They're highly skilled. And our coaches' jobs are to make sure they can take kind of these race cars that we're putting together and then put them in a position to be successful. So we really see ourselves, especially with basketball and being a specialized sport, we really see ourselves as, you know, coaches of, you know, general physical preparation. You know, I think when you look at these guys and how they change direction, how they sprint and how they cut, they're going to get a ton of, you know, jumping, sprinting, XL, D-cells. These things are happening at a high clip at a large amount during the week and during practices. So not only do they retain those qualities very, very well, but it also helps with strength retention as well. So during the season, unless a guy's not playing extended minutes or he's not getting that stimulus in practice and or on the court, my job is to make sure that just the load that which they're being placed under allows them to continue to play not only in games but also in practice. And if they're not playing at a high level or a high amount of minutes, that they're still exposed to the load that they need to not get injured from an acute or a chronic perspective, and keep that load so when their number is called, they're ready to go. So that's kind of how I view it. Our season goes from September, you know, right now, starting October, you know, hopefully until April. So I don't really have a lot of time to do, you know, accelerations and speed work in season. I mean, we will do some, you know, some starts and some things, you know, before practice and kind of keep that fire hot, so to speak. But it's definitely a different juggling act for me than it is for a sport like rugby and what you're exposed to.
That's extremely important for our field to understand. I don't think I'd understood it in that context until you said it, Ryan. And that, you know, we always talk about what are the movement demands of sport, you know, basketball versus Australian football versus ice hockey or whatever. But yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know how much we talk about the dynamics and the environmental constraints of training versus the sport itself. You know, because rugby, you don't really have a chance to play full tilt rugby. In training, everyone would break. Yeah. Did that all the time. You get your drills, you get your tackling drills and stuff like that. But we don't go out and scrimmage every day, right?
Exactly. Yeah, you know, we're getting those type of exposures during our practices. So when our guys are running through their scrimmages in practice, and we're tracking their player load per minute and their total player load, it's very without the excitation from having the crowd and the pressure and playing a real game, the loads are very comparable daily in practice to what they're being exposed in the games. Big men sometimes are going to be a little bit lower. They'll be more intense per minute, but total volume will be lower because they're not covering that type of ground or that type of movement. But we're lucky. I guess that'd be the word. I don't know if it's lucky, but we're able to kind of put that stress and that stimulus on them on a daily basis in practice. Football is the same way. Guys aren't able to scrimmage at the intensities and at the speeds and at the impacts that they're going to have in a game. Then also the same point, too, in basketball, I could be playing Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday one week, and then the next week I'm playing Sunday, Wednesday, Friday. You just never know. So like when you're looking at your training week, you're viewing it not necessarily through a Monday, Sunday type schedule. What you're looking at is, when is our next competition? When is our next game? What does this guy need to be able to do? And what does he have to be able to do to perform not only in practice, but also prepare himself for the game? So you have to really be fluid with your training and what you're trying to do and what you're trying to achieve. But I'm a big believer in the weight room, especially for basketball players, just because they're doing a ton of court work. They're doing a ton of skill work. But the ability to continue to train those tissues, train the central nervous system, load their joints, full ranges of motion in a sport that's a constant, repetitive, small range of motion sport over time, I think it's extremely important. So I value the weight room heavily with our basketball players.
Boy, how fascinating is that in our undergrad they make us pass exams on every different periodization model that's ever been written, but they don't talk to us about the difference between, you know, coaching a sport that plays three times a week versus once every single Sunday, you know, 30 weeks versus in rugby sevens, it's often, you know, two months off or 1 month off and then back-to-back weekends, 6 games in 2 days.
Yeah, I think when you look at those periodization models, and it's something that we go over with our staff, and everybody's invested in the program, we write that program together. It's one of those things when you read, and when I was doing most of my undergrad research and grad school and a lot of my professional development, a lot of those periodization models were developed for Olympic weightlifters. They are developed for track and field athletes where there's a small sum of biomotor and bioenergetic abilities that these athletes need to perform. There's multiple peaking models and so on and so forth. You know, our guys aren't getting multiple peaks. You know, we'll taper some intensity and some structural demand depending on what time of year it is, whether it's out of conference, in conference, and then postseason play. But these guys aren't running multiple peak models. We're not able to go 16 weeks at a time. Those are things that I think that really test you as a coach and as a practitioner and your overall knowledge, and really are you skilled as far as adapting what you need to do, but also at the same point, having a plan in place, having a system in place, and then having your tracking, your monitoring, and your sports science tools to make sure what you're doing in season is reflective of what you prepared for in the off season, and you're continuing to keep these athletes where they need to be, because there's no such thing as maintenance training. The body isn't this static organism that just wants to, you know, it wants a homeostasis, but that's just not how it works. I mean, things change on a daily basis. Sleep, I fought with my girlfriend. I got guys that come in for a morning workout that haven't had fluids in 12 hours, and the first thing they ate was a bag of Welch's grape fruit snacks. It's six fruit snacks. It's like 40 calories, and they're coming in expecting to practice and play a game. So guys are focusing on these higher level things, and I'm trying to make sure my guys drink a Gatorade, can tie their shoes and get their stuff on before they get upstairs. So there's a lot of things that go into that, not to mention there's 15 different personalities or 16 different personalities on the team, 16 different training ages, and then guys have different needs and different values and different attitudes. So I think it's a beast, but it's definitely fun to try to tame and figure out that beast at the same time.
I'm going to steal this question from my friend Ian McEwen of Port Adelaide. What is something that's worked for you in the past year? Tell us a bit about that, something new that you tried or something exciting that you tried, and what's something that didn't work?
I think something that's, you know, worked for us is we've just implemented this year. We've seen it. The K-Box, the flywheel trainer, is something that we've just been really heavily doing the last year. That's something that is still new to me. I don't think doing something for a block or 3 weeks or 4 weeks is necessarily doing something. I think that's trying something and experimenting with it. But now that we've had over a year with the K-Box and using some flywheel training, some inertial type training, that's been a huge key for us. We've seen improvements not only anecdotally, but also on our force plate scans, and then his overall performance and feedback from our athletes and how we're moving and how we're performing. That's been a huge piece for us, especially for our basketball athletes that lack a lot of that eccentric strength, and that eccentric rate of force development's been huge. So that's something that's new that we've started doing, that there's not a lot of information or a lot of practitioners in the game of basketball that's currently using it with guys from 5'11 to 7 foot tall. So that's exciting for me because we're doing something, we're trying it, but we're also kind of, you know, with a small group of coaches that I know that have it, are kind of paving the way, so to speak, in the United States with flywheel training. So that's been huge for us. Something that didn't work, that we try to not do that as much as possible, but something that didn't work for us, I think that goes back to it. We tried to do a little bit, and I've talked about this in the previous podcast, with some Omega Wave and some HRV stuff. We try to do that, a little bit more consistently as far as before and after training sessions. And I think it was a little bit much for the guys. I think it made them feel somewhat robotic. We got great information, but I think that's something during the in-season period where we're better able to control that schedule is a better tool for us in monitoring athlete readiness on a day-to-day basis. So that's something we tried to push a little bit more in the summertime during that period, but it's something that we kind of fell back off of and probably tried to use it a little bit too much. It was a little bit too invasive for what we need and what our time schedule was with our practice. So that's probably something that when we looked at, probably did a little bit too much of that. But yeah, those are a couple things.
So what were your major takeaways from that latter one, Ryan? So What did that teach you about how to implement new monitoring strategies?
I don't think it was new. I think it's one thing for us is when we look at it, how we break up monitoring and tracking. I think that the longer I've been doing it and the more I work with the guys that we have a great group. I think when we look at our guys, they're very respectful and receptive to what we're trying to do to protect them and prepare them at the same time. But I think one thing we tend to do is I don't want things to be a burden necessarily. I mean, these guys aren't professional athletes. These guys are in class for 8 hours a day. They have practice before. They have mandatory meals. Their time is precious. So the longer I coach, the more I've realized to eliminate all the bull crap and all the useless stuff that's causing anxiety, not only in them, but also in myself, and trying to target things. You know, it goes back to the movie American Sniper. It's kind of one of those things where you aim small, you miss small.
Yes.
So when you're looking at how you're trying to target these things, we started off doing a lot of stuff. And I say that we did stuff. But we weren't getting a ton of actionable intelligence, and we weren't using it to drive decision making. So we look at this year, we do internal and external tracking. They wear that. They play basketball. They love it. They wear it. They don't really know it's there, and they drop it off and they walk away. And we're good. So it doesn't necessarily have to take any extra time for them. They can see the data and they know. We use our Fusion, you know, timing system. It's around them. They see it. They use it, but it's not a distraction. It's not poked and prodded, and it's not something they have to really look at. We look at gym aware and looking at velocity-based training. It's something that attaches to the bar that motivates them, that holds them accountable, and it's a part of what we do. We look at the force plate. Hey, step on this force plate and jump. That's what they do every single day. It's easy, it's consistent, and we're getting good information from it. So we've trimmed the fat, so to speak, and we did that. But to make these guys come in earlier, you know, before and after and what the schedule was, we just weren't getting the type of information that we needed because we had guys coming from class. We had guys coming from lunch in the morning. We had guys that had early class. We had guys that, so I mean, all these things in the place. It was one of those situations where what type of information are we getting on it? Are our guys receptive to it? And it's something that we're getting enough benefit to take their time away from. So for me, it's a constant struggle of understanding not only what they're doing, but also teaching the guys too that, hey, we want them to sleep, but I'm going to wake them up 30 minutes earlier. This to tell them, hey, you're overtrained. You need to sleep a little bit more. But then he says, well, coach, you woke me up an hour earlier to come in here. I don't have class. And I'm like, okay, now I'm the dumbass, so to speak. So it's like, sometimes it's like, I have to take a step back and understand, you know, what these guys are going through and put myself in their shoes. But also too, you know, we're pushing the gas pedal all the time with these guys. It's all gas, no brakes, but sometimes it's better just to schedule. You know, we have a great yoga practitioner that works with our guys. Sometimes it's better to teach them how to downshift, how to slow down, put the car in park, step away, be more mindful, and do their own body scans and their own body checks. And that's something that my assistant has brought to the table of teaching our guys how to be mindful of how their body feels. They're very self-aware. My best athletes are the most self-aware ones. They know how they feel when they do certain things, and they know when they don't. So these conversations and these dialogue, I've went to that more, and I'm trying to use the information that I'm getting to just kind of shape those discussions. But the older I get, the more I value those one-on-one personal interactions with our guys to really try to make a long-term lasting change in that 22 hours that they're not with us. So I think that's something that it's a long answer for a short question, but I think that's something that we deal with collegiate athletes, and something that needs to be expressed for the listeners out there that might not be familiar with it.
I think it's a heck of an important answer, Ryan. And just as we talked about the schedule and training constraints earlier, I think it's kind of another blind spot in our industries. I mean, I think a lot of us pride ourselves on being able to go and work with different populations, you know, professional, provincial, national, Olympic, collegiate, wherever, and adjust and do a good job. But it's definitely in a skill set, and it's something that's really important. You know, collegiate athletes versus, you know, multimillionaire professionals are a whole different animal in terms of coaching and compliance and all of that. Last two questions for you today, if that's all right. What's something that you've changed your mind about, or a couple of things that you've changed your mind about as a coach in the last few years?
I think, you know, in my career, I started off, I was a powerlifter early on. I worked for a coach, Tim Contos, and taught Tim Contos at Virginia Commonwealth University. and Todd Hammer at Robert Morris University that were both competitive powerlifters. They were both highly influenced by Louis Simmons and Westside Barbell. I was at my start reading a ton of stuff on Lead FTS, Buddy Morris, Tom Lozinski, you know, Joe Ken, those type of guys on Elite FTS. And I myself was also heavily influenced by Elite FTS and the kind of that Westside Barbell type of training. So early on, I didn't give the Olympic lifts any time of day because I was under the impression if I did box squats with bands, which I'm not saying it's not a great training methodology because we still use that to this day. It's a tool in our toolbox. But I completely abandoned an exercise because overall I wasn't comfortable teaching it. I wasn't patient enough and I wasn't persistent enough to commit to it to reap the rewards or the benefits of what the exercises could do. So over the course of, you know, a 10-year career, the first couple of years of my career, it's something that we didn't do unless we were made to do it. As I've progressed throughout my career and as I've kind of trimmed down the number of exercises that we use, I mean, we use, you know, 7 to 9 primary movements with our student athletes, and majority of those movements are some Olympic lifts or Olympic lift derivatives, especially for a vertical impulse type sport like basketball. A very reactive, elastic sport like basketball. So I have grown to love them, and I've grown to become more proficient at teaching them and including them with our athletes. And then our numbers, you know, have been reflective of utilizing those lifts. Is it for everybody? No. If you feel like throwing med balls and sprinting and doing certain things is better for that, fine. We still throw, we still sprint, we still jump. We still use those movements, but the Olympic lifts are a big bang for our buck, so to speak. And in our opinion, the juice is definitely worth the squeeze as far as taking the time to teach the lifts with a bunch of athletes that, as I said before, can basically produce force but have a lot of trouble reducing that same force or absorbing that energy or that force on the way down, especially from an eccentric standpoint. So the Olympic lifts for me have been something early on I didn't push heavily, but now that I've committed to it, I think that's the big thing. I committed to it. And our staff is committed to it. We reap the rewards now. It's not for everybody. Some people don't like it. That's fine. But those movements, and as well as full range of motion, squatting and hinging and things like that, have been huge for us. So those are some things that I didn't do before, but definitely now is a foundation for our program.
And how about a historical character who you would love to get into a time machine and go have a beer with?
Oh man, historical character. I tell you what, I'm a big fan of history. I'm a big, you know, big fan in our office. You know, we take pride in that. It's a close time. I think you know, for me, Winston Churchill is definitely up there. Teddy Roosevelt sounds like a guy to me that's definitely up there as well. Those are two historical figures, not had anything to do with religion or anything like that, that I read some of their things, and they're no BS type guys. They're men, from what I can stand. And, those are few and far between. So I appreciate the grit, and the resilience and what those guys did. So, I definitely throw those two out there.
That's a pretty good answer, man. Pretty, pretty cool dudes, those two. So Ryan Horn of Wake Forest Basketball, thank you so much for your time.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Check in soon for interviews with Michael Roncarati and Mark Manson. If you leave a review of this episode on iTunes, you'll get a free coaching session with me. See you soon.
To learn more about how you can achieve maximum performance with minimum fuss, sign up to our free newsletter at WellTraveledWellness.com. You'll get actionable insights from real people on how they manage their days to lead ultra-healthy and productive lifestyles. Sign up today at WellTraveledWellness.com.